repulsed by defending against an unjust attack.
Exactly.
It considers it honorable. It considers it dignified. It considers it to be heroic.
Sure.
It considers dying on that way to be heroic. That's why you see that in Britain, because, you know, we like to complain about Britain.
Yeah, we
but
do.
When the British were defending themselves against the Germans' attack...
That's right. They called it their finest hour.
Because it was their finest hour. Because Germans were attacking them, you know, unjustified, you know, in the context of these people fighting each other,
sure.
You know. And so people stood up, and Churchill came and said, we will, you know, what was that?
We'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the fields.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is your natural right as a human being to defend yourself.
Absolutely.
If you're being attacked by another nation.
Sure.
Unjustly.
Yeah, sure.
So we get it. Mm. The West gets defense.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
But we don't have these problems in Iran with our soldiers and the people who went to the war. And we don't have the problems of the soldiers integrating back into society. And we don't have the problems of the families and the widows and the orphans that are that are left over. This is a natural part of human life. When you get attacked, you defend, and those who did it are the greatest heroes.
And the other thing that has to be mentioned,
and this is the path. This is the path of the imams, and this is something that a leader like Imam Khomeini understands.
Yes.
And that's why he said that famous sentence. Again, we're going back to this great, immense, intense personality.
Mm.
He says, the war is a great blessing.
Exactly. Because the other great blessing out of that is also martyrdom. Because martyrdom is a great victory,
listen,
isn't it?
Listen. It doesn't... People can't wrap their heads around this.
Mm.
I'm talking about religious people.
Sure.
I'm talking about people who are, you know, in favor of the revolution.
Sure.
Imam says, because we're so indoctrinated by this Western thinking of war as a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
And then Imam says, it's a great blessing. The war is a great blessing.
Blessing.
The doors of heaven are opened up, go.
Mm.
And they went.
They went, yes.
And they went. And we're still here.
I know, pity.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yes.
And people who weren't there at that time, they don't understand.
No. They don't know what that meant.
Right.
Yeah, I think basically we're at the end of this particular session in terms of what we were discussing in polarization, you know, with the theme during the war. But of course, you know, this is something that even carries on beyond that.
Right.
And it is, there's no doubt, there is, it's an emotional topic, because really, I mean, when we stand up for truth and we really go according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt and understand the teachings of the Quran. And of course, you know, when God says that, you know, if you fight for Allah's cause, you die for Allah's cause, then death is not applicable in this situation. You're living.
You're not. The martyrs are not dead.
They're not dead.
They live and they're being sustained by their God.
They're sustained by their God. And that's what Imam Khomeini re-inculcated back into the Muslim Ummah. This idea that it's not only a great thing to defend your country and to defend your values and to defend your principles, but even if you're killed along the way,
you're a martyr.
You're a martyr. You're somebody of great status.
Right. Your status, your existential state is, you know, raised to that. What you, and it has to do with the fact that you are showing and manifesting your complete obedience and submission to the will of God.
God.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And it's not that kind of browbeating submission, because people have this idea, and in the West we have this image of God as this kind of browbeating.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
It's ridiculous.
The submission is love.
Love.
It's becoming one with your God.
God.
It's, you know, letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
It's entering that paradise, which is God Himself.
Exactly.
Do you understand?
Exactly.
God Himself, you know, paradise is God Himself. It's,
yeah.
You know, being in the present. There are different stages of paradise.
Of course.
I'm not,
of course.
Technically
yeah.
speaking.
Yes.
But what is really what we're talking about is God Himself.
God Himself.
And when you feel that love, and, you know, that's the highest level, because, you know, this is the goal. You're trying to feel that connection with Allah, the love, and that's what we talk about submission. We're not talking about submission as a slave submitting you know, deep south of the, you know, antebellum, you know.
No, we're not talking about that. This is,
you know, it's not that submission. It's a
pure
complete
love.
Yeah, it's pure. A complete letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
And complete trust and giving it over to Allah.
Dr. Mahdi Trabi, on that note, thank you very much indeed for your contribution on The Man Who Changed the World. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Hello and welcome back to The Light. You are gravely mistaken if you think online fitness challenges are age-bound. That's because the latest trend on social media is nothing but Germany's fitness crown. Erika Rischko, 81, cannot wait for the pandemic to come to an end. Nothing can stop her from training either. She has now turned to social media to post videos of her activity. Her posts have become viral, receiving hundreds of thousands of likes and followers. She says getting encouraging comments from young people has made her very confident and motivated.
It's super. It's just great. I'm super happy about it. I have never been as confident about myself as I am at the moment. This whole thing really gave me a push. It's just amazing and crazy. Nobody was expecting this. I thought people would watch, but all this attention, crazy.
In many of Erika's videos, she is joined by her family members. The famous grandma says her major goal is to urge people to remain active even during the pandemic.
Spring is coming and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and the warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view as stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
For some people, it may take years to build a morning running habit. However, this very special runner seems very impatient in sticking to its daily running routine. The 2-meter tall ostrich escaped its dwelling to run alongside vehicles on the streets of Beihai, South China. It even tried to keep up with a car's speed by jogging at a very fast pace. The bird's owner says It opened the gates of the farm it stayed in and escaped. He guided the fugitive bird back to the farm by covering his face with a red cloth. The video of the athlete ostrich went viral after its running was caught on traffic cameras.
Iran has inaugurated the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition according to health protocols. The event is aimed at injecting fresh energy into the tourism industry, which has been badly affected by COVID-19 over the past year. Saman Kujori reports.
Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has been inaugurated according to health protocols announced by the National Headquarters for Coronavirus Control and following the necessary coordination with the relevant agencies in this field. According to organizers, visiting the exhibition in person will be controlled. Only a specific number of people are allowed to visit each day. Officials and experts believe Iran will achieve a tourism boom after the coronavirus outbreak, believing its impact would be temporary and short-lived for a country that ranked the third fastest-growing tourism destination in 2019.
Although we were under sanctions and at the same time corona pandemic badly affected tourism industry across the country, we have developed and completed many projects in the country during this period. We are very optimistic about the future of tourism industry in Iran because we believe good days are around the corner. Iran is a historically and culturally rich country with abundant attractions.
According to the latest data, 8 million tourists visited the Islamic Republic during the first 10 months of the past Iranian calendar year. Iran ranks first globally in terms of the number of handicraft cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. The number of Iranian craft cities and villages stands at 14, while the second place goes to China, which has only 7 craft cities and villages globally registered.
Handicraft exports from Iran before the coronavirus outbreak reached $146 million in the Persian calendar year, which started in March 2019. Iraq and Persian Gulf littoral countries are among the main target markets for Iranian handicrafts.
Under the 2025 Tourism Vision Plan, the country aims to increase the number of tourist arrivals from 4.8 million in 2014 to 20 million in 2025.
Iran's tourism ministry has proposed travel packages under strict health protocols, with the hope of encouraging people to travel and injecting fresh energy to the tourism industry, especially during the upcoming Nowruz holidays. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Feeling frustrated and stressed out, Brazilians have found a place to vent their anger and fury in the newly opened Rage Room. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of Sao Paulo, people can freely swing giant hammers at old televisions, computers and printers. Demolishing the machines and shattering glass into tiny pieces helps to release their pent-up feelings. The 42-year-old who opened the business a month ago says he has received a fair number of customers wanting to vent, especially during the pandemic.
I think it was the best moment to be able to set this up here, related to everything that people are going through, a lot of anxiety, stress. Sometimes people miss work or even work a lot at home. I believe this here is like an escape at the moment.
Wearing protective suits and helmets, participants write issues that bother them on the walls, turning the words into targets of their anger. One might think how much it costs to break all these things up. The Rage Room experience, however, costs just less than $5.
Tens of thousands of flamingos have turned the Indian city of Navi Mumbai pink. Bird lovers gathered near a lake to watch the migrating flamingos. Every year, flamingos migrate to Navi Mumbai between October and March. They go there from northern and western parts of India and sometimes as far away as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Then they fly out in June. This year and last year, their numbers were much higher. Experts say that is because the lake is cleaner thanks to COVID lockdowns. Well, the world's largest snow maze is once again welcoming visitors in Western Canada, offering them a joyful adventure amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attraction opened in mid-February after being in limbo earlier in the winter due to public health measures and unseasonably warm weather. In addition to the giant maze, there are also snow slides as well as snow buildings and huts with artworks inside so the visitors can enjoy other activities besides getting lost.
The massive labyrinth is about 240,000 square feet, twice the size of its record-breaking build in 2019. Designers say the larger layout is a nod to social distancing guidelines.
In 2019, we applied for the title of the world's largest snow maze, which we got in February. And this year, just with COVID and everything, we wanted to make it bigger. And so this year, it's about 91% bigger than the world's largest title that we hold now.
The visitors can only have 5 people in their group, and masks and face coverings are mandatory. Indoor warming areas are closed, and picnic tables are also unavailable due to the pandemic.
Now, after an unprecedented winter storm in some parts of the United States, people in Texas have a rush to rescue sea turtles. The creatures are not used to chilly weather, so they became cold stunned. This is a condition in which sea turtles remain awake but lose the ability to move. Volunteers have so far saved over 4,700 of them off the southern coast of Texas. The rescued turtles were transferred to a convention center and will be freed after the water becomes warmer.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Speaking during an appearance on conservative radio host Dana program, Ted Cruz, who had left Texas with his family to travel to Cancun, Mexico, as millions of residents suffered extreme temperatures without heat, electricity, and running water in the wake of a brutal winter storm, said that the media's coverage of his travels were unfair. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, news writer. This article is published under the heading, "Unrepentant about his Cancun trip, Ted Cruz blames media for publicizing it." Here's more. After attempting to do significant public relations damage control over his jaunt to Mexico, while Texas was in a deep crisis caused by Winter Storm Uri, Senator Ted Cruz is now trying to suggest he is being victimized by the media. Speaking during an appearance on conservative radio host Dana program recently, Cruz, who had left the state with his family to travel to Cancun, Mexico, as millions of residents suffered extreme temperatures without heat, electricity, and running water in the wake of a brutal winter storm, said that the media's coverage of his travels were unfair. He also said he believed the media was looking for a new Republican politician to belittle. The media is suffering from acute Trump withdrawal, where for 4 years every day they could foam at the mouth and be obsessed with former President Donald Trump, Cruz said on the program. And now that he has receded from their day-to-day storyline, they don't know what to do with themselves. The Texas senator made similar complaints on Sean Hannity's Fox News program later that evening. The media is suffering from Trump withdrawal, where they have attacked Trump every day for 4 years. They don't know what to do, so they obsess over my taking my girls to the beach, Cruz said recently. Cruz's exploits were indeed widely covered in the media, but it's questionable whether that was a result of the media not having a subject like Trump to cover, as he suggested. Rather, articles detailing Cruz's travels recently focused on his departure from a state that saw millions without power after an unusual winter storm system caused damage to Texas' electrical grid, which was not equipped to handle severe cold weather events the same day the other two federally regulated grids in the U.S. are. Several U.S. officials in Texas have wrongly blamed renewable energy sources for playing a role in the state's power woes. However, several fact-checking organizations have shown that those types of energy sources weren't to blame for what happened, and that they work well in other, typically colder environments. Many news organizations also noted the inherent hypocrisy in Cruz's flight to Cancun, Mexico, as Cruz himself has criticized other politicians on multiple occasions in the past for traveling when a crisis was underway. As Cruz was going back and forth between Texas and Cancun, at least 7 million residents of his state were under boil water advisories. Food shortages were also prevalent throughout several areas, and at least 32 Texans have died as a result of the crisis overall. Although Ted Cruz had intended to stay in Cancun, Mexico with his family through Saturday, after initial backlash over his holiday on social media, he booked a flight back to the U.S. immediately after landing. In a statement he released recently, justifying why he felt it was appropriate to leave while millions of his constituents were suffering without power, water, and food, Cruz blamed his daughters. He said, "With a school canceled for the week, our girls asked to take a trip with friends, and I wanted to be a father for them."
We get people.
Post-Trump morass.
U.S. President Joe Biden has inherited Earth scorched in every imaginable way from the Democrats' top nemesis, Donald Trump. The former vice president faces myriad challenges both inside the country and abroad after Trump's unconventional presidency.
We can join forces, stop the shouting, and lower the temperature. For without unity, there is no peace, only bitterness and fury. No progress, only exhausting outrage. No nation, only a state of chaos. This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge, and unity is the path forward.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Milad Javamari. In this episode, we'll delve into many challenges ahead of the Biden administration, not just in governance, but also the pandemic, foreign policy, trade, unemployment, and etc. Stay with us.
Biden's future governance will indeed suffer from the embarrassing reaction by Trump and his supporters to defeat in the 2020 race. The totality of the American democracy and the integrity of the country's institution were tested and tried like never before.
In complete defiance of cease and desist letters from state legislature, your state legislature said don't do it. They're the only ones that can approve it. They gave tens of thousands of votes. They came in duffel bags. Where the hell did they come from?
Now, Biden needs to handle what has been exposed to the world and to the Americans by the so-called leader of the free world. We are now joined by Mr. Charles Otell. Mr. Otell, is it fair to describe President Biden's challenges in office as unique, since the transfer of power to him was frankly not that smooth?
Absolutely. The United States of America remains bitterly divided, really going back to 2000 election. And we've gone to the right, we've gone to the left, now we're back to the left. And there is a lingering feeling, not only amongst Republicans and independents, but even among Democrats, that this past election has a lot, let's just put it charitably, has a lot of issues surrounding its legitimacy. So, Joe Biden, any president, but whether it was Trump being reelected or Joe Biden, will face monumental difficulties trying to unite the country, the divided country, around a path forward.
The senior politician faces a nation heavily divided in the past 4 years, some half of whom do not accept him as the country's leader. Some top GOP politicians are even bringing up the idea that the election was stolen and the Supreme Court could end up deciding who the winner of the 2020 election is. So is the country on a path to unity? Let's see what Marcia Baker thinks. Ms. Baker, your take.
President Biden is, and the administration will have a very rocky time unless things get put on the right track. Let's use one example. He said at his inauguration, we have to have unity. That was his theme. But many people within his administration and also connected internationally with London are pushing disunity in the form of identity politics. They're pushing racism. Hillary Clinton, for example, is speaking about whiteness as being the problem in the United States, whiteness.
Thanks for your input, Ms. Marcia Baker.
Biden needs to deal with a much more chaotic West Asia, where Trump's policies have made the region more insecure. People of the region are more emphatic than ever in their demands for the U.S. departure. Muslims in Palestine feel they have been betrayed once again by America, and Israel remains an illegitimate entity despite the former administration's attempts to bring it closer to some Arab nations.
Dictating unilateralism doesn't work. Never worked.
While the Biden administration has welcomed the Trump's normalization initiative, it has reaffirmed support for Israel, and the U.S. keeps maintaining a military presence in the region to defend Israel and its other interests. But has it been worth it?
Many Americans, for several years, have wanted American men and women, troops, withdrawn from Afghanistan, from Syria, from many places in the world, including South Korea. That was part of what got President Trump elected. So that kind of follow through is necessary, but many people in the Trump, in the Biden new administration, just like some inside Trump's administration, oppose that.
One key decision would be about the tensions the Trump administration has raised with Iran. Biden has to decide the path Washington should take in the wake of Trump's disastrous performance in dealing with Iran.
Today, the ball is in the court of the United States, and Washington has to return and fulfill its obligations. Trump's political career has ended, but the JCPOA is still alive. All of his efforts to destroy the JCPOA were unsuccessful, and he failed.
Yes. Biden will have to return to the deal that Trump quit. The unilateral withdrawal was not just disrespectful to just Tehran, but to the global community, which threw its support behind the agreement. From the U.S. allies in Europe to China and Russia, the new U.S. president will have to deal with ramifications of the blatant breach of trust engineered by the pro-Israeli Trump administration.
For a start, the former U.S. vice president will have to regain trust and send a message of peace. But historically, how could the U.S. foreign policy be assessed, for example, in dealing with Iran?
Now let's see what Danny has for us. He's expected to shed light on how the lives of Trump voters could be affected by the new president, particularly considering the fact that Trump never actually conceded defeat in the November election. Hello, Danny.
Thank you, Milad. Our topic this week will look into the impact that the Biden administration will have on Trump's most loyal supporters and what this says about the political direction of the United States. Donald Trump supporters are not going away. The U.S. is fast becoming a non-white nation whose racist origins are as American as apple pie. Wealth inequality and economic decline are a fact of American life. And the U.S. shows no signs of letting up its quest for hegemony vis-a-vis endless war. In fact, a Biden administration will likely embolden Trump supporters by exacerbating the conditions that led to Donald Trump's rise in the first place. Biden will preside over a more racially quote-unquote diverse cast of imperial characters who will champion war and austerity as a precondition to American exceptionalism. Perhaps more importantly, Biden will seek to marginalize the left wing in the United States in order to consolidate power for his friends in Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. His treatment of Bernie Sanders and his supporters is a prime example. Biden long ago declared that, quote-unquote, nothing will fundamentally change for the wealthy. He opposes Medicare for All. He opposes a Green New Deal. He opposes a reduction in the military budget, all of which Bernie Sanders and his millions of supporters are on board for. This orientation will only further alienate young workers and oppressed people hungry for real change. The Democrats, including Biden, also spent 4 years under Donald Trump more concerned about a conspiracy of so-called Russian collusion than the needs of the people. Not much has changed. Biden's diverse rule over the levers of American power will thus push the entire country further to the right, giving Trump supporters plenty to chew on in election cycles to come.
Trump's anti-climate policies, such as quitting the Paris deal and the ban on the entry of Muslim-majority countries, were among Biden's go-to moves on the first day. But the grave task Biden will have is justly distributing the COVID vaccine and handling the economic repercussions from the pandemic, such as unemployment.
The Biden team has seen no real plan set up by the previous administration to tackle the coronavirus pandemic. Now he says nothing can change the trajectory of the COVID pandemic over the next several months. Isn't that strange?
We don't really have the granular data that I would have expected to see before we locked down the economy. Blue states like California and New York have done a horrific job with all the resources they were given to get the vaccines out. So we have not covered ourselves in glory as a nation in America in this COVID pandemic. We have a lot to learn from it. And I would fully expect Joe Biden and his team to do a dismal job. As recently as the last 24 hours, Biden has said that he cannot alter the trajectory of the COVID pandemic, having said when he campaigned that that was his primary goal.
Biden will have a tough road ahead in pushing his plan forward to tackle the pandemic. Biden has vowed to get 100 million vaccine shots to Americans within his first 100 days. The White House has called for urgent action by Congress, which is controlled by his own party, to send more money to hard-hit communities with over 400,000 people killed.
Many public health labs are not equipped to detect new coronavirus variants, such as ones first identified in the United Kingdom and South Africa. When demand surges, some labs struggle to complete timely tests, and millions of people are waiting to be vaccinated. Biden is also extending restrictions to some travelers.
Well, strange that just after Biden was installed in the White House, suddenly the WHO and peer-reviewed journals are backing off arguments that animated the headlong rush to shut down the U.S. economy and other economies around the world. I think there's no question that issues posed in flu season by perhaps COVID, but by influenza and pneumonia, the disease I suffered from twice, that I could tell you is rough. These are serious issues, but I think they were demagogued, they were politicized. We do not have robust data in the U.S. California, for example, is refusing to provide granular data on how many people got COVID, how many cases there were, and how many people didn't die with COVID.
On the other hand, there are the old concerns that the radical left would use rather centrist presidents to pursue its own agenda, which would certainly divide the country even further.
There are also hopes that Biden can keep a balance and consider the rights of people from various walks of life. The Democrats' years of experience in politics could definitely come handy. But the new era Biden is setting foot in other unique properties and challenges that threaten the United States' totality in the 21st century. But will the divide allow for a peaceful dialogue?
We have quite an extreme situation developing in the United States right now. One thing that's happened is the big tech companies doing the bidding for political financial interests connected to City of London and Wall Street have just shut down through Facebook, through shutting Instagram, through shutting even YouTube. The president of the United States, when Trump was still in, many groups around the country doing this in the name of protecting free speech, but it's actually a lie. It's been deployed to quiet down the actual discussion in the nation.
Superpowers such as China, India, and Russia have been undermining U.S. hegemony. A Biden presidency is what Russia and China want. This is the idea being promoted by supporters of the former president. Biden is putting in efforts to look tough on U.S. rivals. However, he has loads on his hands to make up for on the backdrop of Trump's aggressive approach in dealing with America's rivals.
It's something that just surprised the whole world. And if people would have known about it, it could have been stopped in place. It could have been stopped right where it came from, China. If we would have known about it, if they would have known about it, it could have been stopped in its tracks. Unfortunately, they didn't decide to make it public, but the whole world is suffering because of it. I called for a ban from people coming in from China long before anybody thought it was. In fact, it was your network. I believe they called me a racist because I did that.
Trump alienated the EU and embarked on dead-on-arrival initiatives in ties with Moscow and Beijing. A bipartisan majority of the U.S. politicians agree that China should be contained. But what options does Biden have in dealing with superpowers such as China and Russia in the wake of Trump's disruptive policies?
Yeah, I would put them in two different camps. China is a gigantic economy in terms of people. We can debate whether its economic output is as large as some people estimate it to be, but it is a far more significant country geopolitically and economically than Russia. Unfortunately, from the perspective, my perspective and Trump supporters, U.S. interests, globalists in the U.S. government have ill-advisedly shifted production outside this country to China. And many of the large investors, large multinationals, large banks are enthralled to a country of the future, rejecting the economy of today. The U.S. economy, even hurt now, is the largest economy by far in the world. And so Biden clearly will try to mend fences with China.
Biden administration officials say there will be no reset of the American relationship with Moscow. Biden could try to end the nuclear arms race, which was pumped under Trump. The Kremlin welcomed Biden's proposal to extend the last remaining nuclear arms control treaty between the two countries. Biden has reportedly proposed to Russia a 5-year extension of the new START treaty, START.
I can confirm that the United States intends to seek a 5-year extension of New START as the treaty permits. The president has long been clear that the New START treaty is in the national security interests of the United States, and this extension makes even more sense when the relationship with Russia is adversarial, as it is at this time. New START is the only remaining treaty constraining Russian nuclear forces and is an anchor of strategic stability between our two countries.
Biden has also ordered a sweeping review of American intelligence about the role Russia is being accused of having in a highly sophisticated hacking of government and corporate computer networks. So will the Biden administration be friendly?
What President Biden should do is the kind of thing President Trump did right at the beginning of Trump's administration when he went to China to visit Xi Jinping, when he invited Xi Jinping to Florida, when President Trump met with President Putin in Helsinki. Remember, it was after that that the British geopoliticians moved in against Trump to play him, to have him turn instead against Russia and China. So Biden should, his administration should meet at the earliest time with Russia, China, India.
Biden is going to be at the helm of the same imperialist system his predecessors were running, regardless of their past policies and personal characteristics. Therefore, it does not make much sense to expect a real change in the way American government imposes ideas on the rest of the world and even on its own people.
It's been a month since Donald Trump left office, but he's still dominating the corporate media headlines as Democrats fail to secure a conviction in their unprecedented second impeachment trial of the former president. I'm joined for this episode of We the People by Professor David Schultz. He is a professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Professor Schultz, thanks so much for being here with us. Now, a lot of people are wondering just where exactly is all of this going. So we want to get your take. What do we make of Donald Trump going forward? Is he really yesterday's news, or can he still upset the apple cart when it comes to either the Republican Party or the Biden administration?
Okay. Now, let's start off by saying if there wasn't going to be an impeachment trial starting next week, I would say to a large extent Trump was already yesterday's news. That, you know, since he left office, you know, approximately, you know, 10 days ago, he's been silent. He's been cut off from the social media. And to a large extent, I think he's been ostracized by some segments of the Republican Party. However, the impeachment trial next week gives him a free forum to come to really basically come back to be able to make his case to the American public. He's not going to change many minds, but what he's going to do is reinvigorate his base. So he'll have a reinvigorated base. He will still have quite a bit of money from his campaign war chest. He potentially has an ability to be able to influence the Republican Party, although I do think at this point his influence within the mainstream Republican Party has been weakened quite a bit. The question becomes, does he form a third party? If he does, that third party is going to further weaken the mainstream Republican Party. So where I see it at this point is that while, let's say, 2 weeks ago, he still looked like a fairly formidable figure in American politics, even with the bump he's going to get next week, the prospects of Donald Trump, I think, having a major influence on the Republican Party goes down, but he does have a chance of being able to influence or create perhaps a weak third party in the United States.
Well, let's discuss that point there for a minute. I want to direct your attention to a couple of polls that have come out recently. Politico found that a majority, 54%, of Republicans surveyed late last week had a strongly favorable opinion of Trump. And an Ipsos poll found that 57% of Republicans believe that Trump should be the party's nominee in 2024, even after all of this. So you think he's really done at this point? And do you think a third party, should he choose to form one, would be in such a weak position?
Couple of observations. You're right. He still enjoys quite a bit support in the Republican Party. Remember, this is down from about, what, 90% support that we saw a few weeks ago. So certainly not saying he doesn't still have some opportunities here, but I think partly what came to a head on January 6th in the United States is really sort of is the war within the Republican Party right now. And it's not for certain that he's going to lose it, but I think he's more likely at this point, if he does anything, to go that third-party route, simply because of the fact that I think there are a lot of forces within the Republican Party right now that are going to be in a much better position than they were 5 years ago to be able to prevent him from having a presidential future. Second is that as influential as he may be with his base, American law makes it incredibly hard for third parties to flourish. That what would wind up happening here, we would have a somewhat united Democratic Party facing, let's say, a Trump third party and a, whatever we call it, traditional Republican Party. That fracturing of the Republican base would probably make it very difficult for either the Trump Party or for the regular Republican Party to do well across the country. Not saying that he wouldn't elect some people. I think there are a variety of places where Trump candidates would do well. But again, it would be dramatically weaker as a party than it is right now.
Hard to say just exactly what is in store for the two-party system here in Washington, D.C., but a lot to think about going forward. We want to thank our guest, Professor David Schultz, so much for being here with us. We want to thank viewers at home for tuning in. For Press TV's We the People, I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
Rather than actually progressing, Biden is expected to be trying to resolve myriad conflicts exacerbating within the past 4 years, both inside and outside the United States. The question is, can he make it? We'll have to see. Well, that was our show. I'm your host, Mila Javamadi. Please also tune in next week when we'll try to find out if there's an American media monopoly on We the People.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The issue of Iran's defensive and missile power. It has been proven that the Islamic Republic's presence helps eliminate the causes of instability, such as the issue of Daesh in Iraq, various matters in Syria, and the like. I do not wish to enter into details, but those who are involved in these matters are aware of this perfectly. Therefore, this regional presence is definite. It should and will exist. As for our defensive power, the Islamic Republic does not have the right to allow the defensive condition of the country to be in a way that incompetent individuals such as Saddam Hussein will be able to come and bombard the city of Tehran, to drop missiles on it, and to fly their MiG-25 fighter planes over the Tehran sky while we are not able to do anything. This happened once.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Tehran, the people used to be bombarded either by Iraqi missiles, which had been given to him by the European excellencies, as a result of which his missiles could cover the distance between Baghdad and Tehran, let alone for other cities, or by his MiG-25 fighters at high altitudes. We were not able to do anything, as we did not have enough resources. The Islamic Republic does not have the right to put the country in this situation, and by Allah's favor, we have not put it in this situation. Today, our defensive power is such that our enemies have no choice but to take Iran's capability into consideration. When the missiles of the Islamic Republic are able to strike the transgressing US drone, when they are able to demolish the Ain al-Asad airbase, then the enemy will be forced to take our country's power and capability into account when he wants to make calculations or make military decisions. We should not leave the country defenseless. This is our responsibility. We should not do something to give the enemy the boldness to attack and to render ourselves defenseless in front of him.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah.
ministry.
When the U.S. says Iran, Israel jumps and shouts, nuclear program. Well, if you still haven't noticed that this is just a performance Israel uses to cover up its own secret stockpile of nuclear warheads, come along, let me tell you the story of a not-so-secret actual nuclear facility in our region that even the U.S. is not allowed to visit despite its generous aid funds to the host entity. The UK's Guardian newspaper reported last week that Israel's top secret nuclear research facility near the southern city of Dimona is undergoing a major expansion, claiming the construction work is visible in satellite imagery published by an independent expert group. But wait, hold on a second. That's the same Israel that has worked day and night to sanction Iran and even pushed to start a war with Iran under the pretext that the latter had a secret nuclear program, although Iran allows regular inspector visits from the IAEA. That same Israel. You see, Israel started the construction work at the Dimona site sometimes in early 1958, but it took the United States intelligence community almost 3 long years to discover the site for what it was, namely a nuclear site under construction. In early December 1960, the CIA distributed its findings to the other government agencies, including the White House, State Department, and Congress. Et voila, Dimona was revealed. For decades, the world has known that the massive Israeli facility near Dimona in the occupied Naqab Desert was the key to its secret nuclear project. Yet for decades, the world and Israel knew that Israel had once misleadingly referred to it as a textile factory. Since the early 60s, world leaders knew that the Israelis were seeking an eventual nuclear weapons capability. However, not once did they see it as a threat to strategic stability in the Middle East, and a nuclear proliferation threat the way they wail about Iran's non-existent one. It's a particularly fascinating story set against the backdrop of the modern-day international negotiations over Iran's unproven nuclear program, while Israel continues to pursue a policy of ambiguity of how much it has upped its stockpile of nuclear warheads since the program started back in the 50s. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Israel's top secret nuclear research facility near the southern city of Dimona is undergoing a major expansion. To this day, Israel has never acknowledged that it has a nuclear arsenal, instead maintaining a policy of nuclear ambiguity, while Western governments have played along with the